Velkommen til sesong 3 av Korrespondentene. Dere har nå selskap av Vegard Kristiansen Kåle.
God dag, god dag.
Mathias Ask.
Hei.
Og jeg heter Roy Kvatningen. Vi befinner oss som vanlig i New York City i USA. Det siste var kanskje nok så kjent for de fleste av dere. Vi er tilbake. Dette er første episode av sesong 3, og vi skal satse større og bedre enn noensinne. Vi skal bli best av nordmenn som driver politisk podcast i New York. Yes. Hvordan kan vi gå ut med sånne store ord da, dere? Hva er det som har skjedd?
Nei, det er jo selvfølgelig, blant annet så har vi da fått litt støtte fra Fritt Ord til å fortsette denne podcasten, og det betyr at vi kan satse enda litt mer på dette prosjektet, som jo foreløpig har vært ganske sånn hobbybasert.
Ja, det må så være. Tusen takk til Fritt Ord for det.
Veldig, veldig takknemlig for det. Nå er det rett og slett mulig for oss å reise litt.
Ja, håper å få litt flere gjester. Ta dere med litt tur rundt i USA. Vi har noen planer som vi skal komme litt mer tilbake til om noen episoder, men vi håper at vi kan i hvert fall be folk om at de kan begynne å glede seg allerede.
Ja, og vi starter med et smell, synes jeg. Vi har i denne episoden besøk av journalisten som fikk Pulitzerprisen i 2017 for sin dekning av USAs president Donald Trump og hans forretningsimperium. Journalisten heter David Farenthold og blitt et stort navn her borte.
Ja, jobbet for Washington Post.
Han hadde vel, det var du som fortalte meg, Mathias, han hadde vel en sånn 5000 følgere på Twitter for et par år siden, og nå har han over 500 000.
Ja, nei, han hadde jo en utro, altså det var jo virkelig et gjennombrudd for han, valgkampen i 2016, da han først han dekket vel et par andre kandidater først, og så begynte han å fokusere på om Donald Trump hadde gitt penger til veldedighet som han hadde lovet, og det ble etter hvert en ganske stor oppgave.
Ja, det er jo veldig sånn vanlig for journalister i amerikanske medier her, at de blir satt til å følge en kandidat, og så forsvinner jo kandidatene ut av valgkampen en etter en. Så hans kandidat falt ut, og da antar jeg, dette spurte jeg ikke om som jeg kan huske, men jeg vil anta at han bare da måtte finne et tema som ikke allerede ble dekket av de som dekket Trump. Og da valgte han å fokusere på hans businesser og inkludere sosiale medier, og det var starten på det som er en veldig spennende suksesshistorie.
Ja, er en veldig, veldig interessant person og et bra intervju.
Og så, ja, så må jeg også legge til at han var jo den, også blant annet med på å skrive denne saken om denne berømte Access Hollywood-videoen, ja, til Donald Trump.
Ja, det var han, ja. Han og en til. Ja, så han breaka Access Hollywood. Det er også en nok så stor greie for en journalist.
Definitivt.
Apropos det å vinne fram med journalistikken sin, vi var jo alle tre i Washington da statsminister Erna Solberg var på besøk. Et veldig vellykket statsbesøk, må du lov å si.
Ja, helt til dagen derpå, da Trump var så begeistret for nordmenn at det bestemte seg for å la det gå ut over stakkars folk fra Haiti og El Salvador og andre afrikanske land. Ja. Så Erna dro hjem, vi andre nordmenn som har blitt i USA, vi har jo fått høre hver dag om shithole og hvor bra vi har det og så videre.
Ja, ja. Men det er jo sant, vi har det jo bra, tross alt. Men jeg synes Erna klarer seg veldig bra. Men det som, vi er jo, selv om vi driver en podcast sammen, så er vi også konkurrenter. Jeg tok inn på Trump International i Washington, fordi det er et beryktet hotell, vil jeg nesten si. Det er der mange av de inntektene Trump har som han egentlig ikke skal ha, gjennom denne emoluments-klausulen med fremmede statsledere som bor der, fordi da tjener Trump penger på dem, og de håper å få noen tjenester tilbake. Så Mathias og jeg, vi sjekket inn der, i håp om å finne noen celebre gjester og sånt nå. Vi så jo Sean Spicer, eller i hvert fall en i selskapet vårt så Sean Spicer, men du tok rotta på oss der, Vegard.
Ja, det er jo selvfølgelig ren dyktighet, det har med å gjøre. Men det var jo da vi hadde, jeg var der med min kollega fra Dagbladet, vi spiste middag på restauranten der, og hadde jo egentlig tenkt å lage en slags reportasje mot det, men visste ikke helt hva vi skulle få ut av det enda. Og så viser det seg jo da at når vi sitter der, så har da Jared Kushner, Trumps svigersønn, da en liten bursdagsmiddag med sin kone
Ivanka.
Ivanka, ja, tre bord bortafor. Og som en sånn liten ekstra glasur på kaka så kom det til og med sånn Spicer og satte seg noen bord bortafor og de ble stående og prate lenge og så kom de bort til oss og det var veldig sånn vi altså de utvekslet liksom noen ord med de og de ja det ble det helt tatt fullt mulig å skrive en ganske morsom reportasje av den situasjonen. Og det var jo en ganske det det sier noe om som jo den litt seriøse biten av det jo det der med altså når det gjelder liksom Trumps forretningsvirksomhet og hvordan de altså tydeligvis går og spiser på restaurant på sitt eget hotell sannsynligvis for å bygge opp en slags sånn branding rundt seg selv og familien liksom glamorøst og her har vi liksom en sånn trygg havn for Trump-velgerne I Washington D.C. og foreløpig så dette hotellet et av de stedene I Trump-imperiet som sånn økonomisk sett går ganske bra mens andre deler av det imperiet har slitt etter at han ble president.
Ja, og det kommer dere til å høre litt mer om I intervjuet med David Farenthold fra The Washington Post. Så det en glede å bare sette videre til det, og så kommer vi tilbake med neste episode om en ukes tid.
Thank you for joining us, David. How has the first year of covering the Trump presidency been for you?
It's been busy. It's been really, really, really busy. We've had to adapt to a new world of news where there is never a slow day. And what starts out like a slow day just means that there's going to be some sort of incredibly crazy news by the end of the day. So it's been, you know, we felt very vital, like people really care about what we're doing and people really paying attention to our coverage. But it has been exhausting at times.
What has the presidency meant for the Washington Post in terms of readership and maybe staff priorities?
Well, it's continued a trend that began during the election, which was that we have a lot more people reading us and we're making more money on it. So, you know, we were a business that many people didn't see a future for a few years ago. And now we're 2 years in a row of actually making money. And we've gotten into I'm learning more about the newspaper business all the time. We've gotten into the real cream of the crop of newspaper ads, which is watch ads. We're getting ads for wristwatches. And apparently when you get ads for wristwatches, like you know, that's the best you can possibly get, wristwatches. So we're there.
Congrats, I guess.
Thank you, man. So the New York Times every year puts out like a magazine that's like 50 pages of pictures of watches. And I always wonder, like, why? What are they doing? That's why. Yeah. Watch money is incredible. Anyway, so you mentioned staff priorities. So it's changed the way we cover Washington in a couple of ways. One, our White House bureau has to be on call all the time. I mean, you're not just waiting for a presidential press conference. You know, he could tweet at 5 o'clock in the morning, and we have to have somebody who's ready to cover it. But also, we're trying to deal with just a much faster moving environment. Even people who cover Congress, or people who don't really cover Trump directly. Congress has started moving so much faster because they're trying to sort of ram through all these things before anybody recognizes really what's in the bill. And so every part of the operation, you can't take a month to get to learn the subject anymore. You have to know, you have to come in when they start tax reform, when they start talking about tax reform, you have to be ready to opine about it right then to understand it. There's no time to get up to speed.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit more about your work specifically, because you covered one of the more unusual aspects of this presidency, which is that the president is also a real estate mogul with golf courses and hotels around the world. And you started covering this during the election. Can you talk a little bit more about your work and how it's continued after he was elected?
Sure. I started out during the election covering Trump's charity mainly, like things he had promised, like times he'd promised to give money to charity, and often he had not actually given the money. And since the election, as you said, I've really focused on the Trump Organization. So it's a weird business. It's kind of a hodgepodge of a bunch of different businesses in one. They make water, they have a modeling agency, but mainly it operates a sort of luxury condos, hotels, and golf courses. And so we've tried to figure out two things. One, how is the presidency affecting those businesses? Is he making more money or less money? And number two, is he using the presidency to sort of enrich himself through his businesses or to enrich his customers, his allies, people he knows through his businesses? And the first question I can answer much better than the second. And the really interesting thing there is, you might have thought going in, well, you know, the president has so much power, people are going to want to suck up to him through his businesses. His businesses must be about to have a boom. And that's been true in some cases, like the Trump Hotel here in Washington, D.C., where a lot of, where the president himself hangs out, his family hangs out, his, you know, his staffers hang out. That place has done really well because you can pay money and get access to the presidency. Other parts of the Trump empire, though, golf courses around the world, hotels in New York City and Toronto have really suffered because those businesses are in places where he just needs everyday regular customers to come and use the business despite the fact that they live in cities where people don't like Donald Trump. So it's really pulled the businesses in opposite directions, and some places have really been hurt by Trump's politics.
Yeah, and you had a story recently, or this week, where you wrote about how some hotel owners struggle to get rid of the Trump name?
Yes. So that's what's really interesting. Trump's customers, the people that he cultivated as the customers for his businesses before he ran for office, are basically the inverse of the people he appealed to when he ran for office. So, you know, as a candidate, he appealed to rural folks, people without a lot of income, people sort of resentful of the world that passed them by. And it was the opposite for his business. His business is all about liberal, urban, very successful people. The whole appeal of the business was like, you're successful, you've earned it, come stay in this fancy place with other fancy, liberal, successful people. And so after the election, those people didn't want to stay at the Trump Hotel anymore. So what we found is that there's a lot of hotels that have Trump hotels that customer base has just deserted them. And they've gone from, you know, 50% occupancy, 60% occupancy down to 25 or lower. And the people who – often these are hotels that Trump doesn't own himself. He just has a license, his name, and he operates them. Somebody else owns the business. Hmm. And so the people who own those hotels have said, oh, man, we got to get the Trump name off in fact, because we're going to go out of business. So far already in Toronto, in Soho, which is a neighborhood of Manhattan, and in Panama City – The owners of these hotels have said, look, we have to get the Trump, you know, within the first year of the Trump presidency, you know, this name is an anchor. We have to get it off. Mm. And so we wrote about how the name has already come off in Toronto and Soho. And in Panama, the people who own that building are really fighting hard to get it off.
I wonder if you could explain a little bit more, I think, for our listeners who might not understand the whole picture. But as you kind of pointed out, there are some of these buildings that Trump isn't even involved on the business side. He just, you know, kind of sells and markets the buildings with his name. I guess that creates an interesting dynamic.
So one of the really confusing things about covering the Trump business empire is that there are a lot of buildings out there that say Trump on them, that Trump himself doesn't own, doesn't manage, doesn't have any connection to, other than he basically sold his name to people who own the building, and they put it on there thinking that this is 5 years ago or 10 years ago, that they could get a higher price, they could get more customers, that people thought it was a Donald Trump building versus somebody else's building. So that means that now, if his name, the meaning of his name has changed, and a lot of these people want to get the name off, it's not that, you know, Trump himself has control over the building. Instead, these buildings are owned by other people, other investors. In some of the hotel cases, actually, the individual hotel rooms are owned by individual investors, and then there's sort of an association of hotel room owners, and those are the people trying to kick Trump out. It means he has less leverage if people decide the Trump name is dragging them down.
Hmm. So your way of doing journalism, your open way of doing journalism, obviously won you a Pulitzer Prize. Congrats on that.
Thank you.
Is that way of doing it important when most of the things you're doing is negative for Donald Trump? Because we get a lot of feedback from even Norwegian readers that we're out to get him all the time because most articles are negative.
I think it is important. I mean, in the era of people calling what we do fake news, I like the ability to show people, look, here's what I'm doing, here's what I know, here's what I don't know. You know, you can use social media to watch me sort of accumulate information and accumulate facts in real time. And I think people find that interesting in a way that surprised me, even though, you know, what I'm doing is not, you know, it's not the kind of journalism any movie's about, right? I'm not bringing down a president. I'm not, you know, doing anything really dramatic. I'm just making phone calls. People like watching sort of the hunt. They like watching somebody solve a mystery, even a kind of a lame and mundane mystery. So people are entertained by that, but also people really, I think, trust the final product more if they've seen it come together. So that's really that's been my approach, at least, and I think it's paid off. People have really been interested in watching these things play out, and I think maybe people from that get a little better understanding of how hard we're working to try to tell the complete story.
So how much feedback do you get from Trump supporters?
Not a lot, actually. Less than you would think. I don't get that much abuse. Now, my name is hard to spell, and so maybe people, miss it on the first try and send it to somebody else. But I don't actually get that much. I find that, sometimes I think maybe my open approach is having an effect and that people are less likely to abuse me. But I also think that there's a lot of gender dynamics on this. Female reporters get so much more abuse than male reporters, and that's been true forever, especially now.
Yeah. What's been the biggest surprise for you on the Trump candidacy and presidency?
The biggest surprise for me on my own beat has been what I said earlier, that so many of these businesses have suffered, and have suffered pretty quickly when I thought the presidency might be a boon all over. The biggest surprise for me about Trump politically is how poorly he used the huge amount of leverage and political capital he had at the beginning of his administration. If you remember the beginning of his administration, the Republicans were scared of him because he had just beaten everybody in their party and brought them this miraculous victory. The Democrats were afraid of him because there were so many Democratic senators who were now representing states that had gone so strongly for Trump. And the Democrats were afraid of him, too. So he had this ability that I think he could have done a lot of – Trump could have made a lot of changes if he had not – if he had been a little more bipartisan at the beginning, or if he had not done things that sort of deliberately alienated people. If he had started his presidency by saying, we're going to cut taxes and we're going to do infrastructure, so we're going to put a bunch of people back to work building things that people want, fixing up airports, fixing up roads. Even if it would have cost a ton of money, if it bankrupt the country, I think the people in power, other people in power, would have let him do it. And he would have been so popular. I think he could have had so much leverage in popularity just because people's expectations were so low for him. He could have done a little bit to sort of seem bipartisan and statesmanlike and got an enormous amount of popularity and power right at the beginning. But instead, what did he choose to fight about at the beginning? How big his inauguration crowd was? It's an obvious falsehood about that. And also the ban on people from these majority Muslim nations, which galvanized a huge amount of support. It was done so poorly that the court shot it down right away. That produced this sense of outrage, but also empowerment among his opponents. That they said, Trump's done this thing that makes me angry, and look, I can do something, and then I can win. I can beat him in the courts. So Trump, he just shot himself in both feet right off the bat. In a way that I guess now looking back at the way that he's wielded power, it's not surprising, but he had such an opportunity that he wasted.
I can add foreign policy to that because I covered the UN a lot. And kind of like you said, in the beginning of his administration, there was a lot of apprehension and people were really worried about really not pissing him off, to say it plainly. And then, in the past couple of months, you just don't see it anymore. And I think a lot of it had to do with the Paris Agreement, where there was a lot of pre-pulling out of the Paris Agreement, people thought maybe we can work with him, try to salvage a relationship here, steer him in sort of what they consider the right direction. And after he pulled out of Paris, it was just like, well, that's done.
Yeah. I think so. I feel like he has ended up with so little leverage and he started out with so much.
So your work has also resulted in a book.
Yes.
Tell us about it.
Well, the book is mainly a compilation of everything that I did in 2016, the coverage that won the Pulitzer. So this individual stories and then a long essay I wrote about sort of what it was like to report those stories. It was not the world's hardest book to write because I've mostly written everything in it. But you can get everything from 2016, which now seems like ancient history in more ways.
And what are you working on now? Anything specific?
So the thing that's occupying us now is Trump Panama, this ill-starred resort and hotel in Panama City that he has his name on. There's a really crazy court case we're going to be writing about today that involves the people who own the hotel and want to kick Trump out. And the Trump Organization, the president's company, is accusing his business adversaries in this case of racketeering, basically accusing them of federal crimes. It's this really wild case that it was not unusual for the Trump Organization. That's the kind of wild disputes they often have, but it is unusual for a president. So I'm trying to figure out what's going to happen next with that hotel this week.
Interesting. Thank you so much for joining us, David.
Thank you.
And good luck in the future.
Yeah, it was a real pleasure.
Thank you. Talk to you soon.
Yeah, take care.